From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. How do we think? We humans have 3 pounds of gray matter, of brain, and a whole universe to make sense of. How do we do it? My guests today say it's all about analogy. Our brains as analogy machines, linking this to that and that to the other, endlessly, ravenously. This hour on Point, how we think, the human brain as analogy machine. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Does it make sense to you, to your brain, this idea? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Bloomington, Indiana, is a celebrated lifelong student of the mind, Douglas Hofstadter. Pulitzer Prize-winning author very early with his mind-bending 1978 book, Gödel, Escher, Bach. Now professor of cognitive science and comparative literature and director of the Center for Research on Concepts and Cognition at Indiana University. Author of I Am a Strange Loop and co-author with Daniel Dennett of The Mind's Eye. Now out with his magnum opus on human thought, surfaces, and essences. Analogy is the fire and fuel of thinking. And with us from just outside Paris, France, is his partner in thought and co-author, Emmanuel Sander, professor of cognitive and developmental psychology at the University of Paris, Saint-Denis, author of Analogy from the Naive to the Creative. Douglas Hofstadter, Emmanuel Sander, welcome to On Point. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Our pleasure.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Emmanuel and Douglas. Douglas Hofstadter, you've been at this a long time, and here comes your magnum opus. Give it to us just in a nutshell. We've got an hour to dig in, and I'm so looking forward to it. But tell us the basic here so our listeners can begin to get focused on where you're coming from. What are you telling us now about how we think?
Well, people think that the word analogy is some kind of rarity, some kind of delicacy that happens every so often in thinking. And what we're saying is that, in fact, when we perceive the world, what we do is we focus in on various aspects of the world. We ignore most of what there is. We focus in on some kind of essence, and that essence is recognized by us as being an instance of something we've encountered before. We have we go into a hotel and we look. We're trying to find the elevator, and we have never been in this hotel before. But we walk into a corridor. We look for a sort of a recess in the wall. We know that elevators tend to be of a certain size. They tend to be recessed. We look for buttons. We have a sense as to what height the buttons will be and how big they will be. All of this comes to us because of prior experience. We're mapping the current situation, which is totally new to us, onto previous situations that we have never encountered before.
Emmanuel, is this recreated with each new birth? Every human being from the cradle has to begin accumulating this body of observation to make analogy? And how does it work, starting with a blank slate? If this is how we think, how do we get from blank to this massive analogy that makes up, I guess you're saying, something like our intelligence?
Yeah, that's true. The idea is that we start from singular things that we experience in our life, and from this singularity we have a natural tendency to generalize it and to expand it, to turn it into what we explain to be a category or a concept. And so the idea is that human beings are starting from individual feelings, experience in the world, and they generalize it. We take the situation of a mummy for a toddler, and the idea that at the beginning it's only one, it is our own mummy, and then he will, by analogy, generalize it to other mummy of other small children, and then to mummies of adults, and it can also have more metaphorical meanings. But all this is a continuum. It's a semantic continuum, and it indicates the natural way we are building concepts. For instance, the concept of moon. Once, a few centuries ago, there was only one moon, which was turning around the Earth. But thanks to Galileo, moon became a common name. And this is the same process, which is a building of categories through analogy from single exemplars.
So the brain there as analogy machine. Emmanuel Douglas Hofstadter, you write, without concepts, there can be no thought. And without analogies, there can be no concepts. Each concept in our mind owes its existence to a long succession of analogies made unconsciously over many years. Take us through once more, Douglas, that process. And how do you get from analogy all the way up to concept?
Well, the idea of an analogy, to make it, just to spell it out a little bit, is that what we have in front of our eyes, if we're looking or imagining or listening, but let's say a visual scene, is that we create on our retina, there is some kind of image created, and that is sent back into our brain, and it builds a representational structure for what we're dealing with. But we have to simplify that structure in order to make sense of it, because what's on the retina is 100 million cells firing, and that's we can't make sense of 100 million things. We have to reduce it. We have to find some kind of essence to it, and so we start integrating and making throwing things away and throwing tons of information away and getting down to a much simpler structure. And that structure then is mapped onto prior experiences. We try to find something that we have experienced before that we recognize. Maybe it's a pen, maybe it's a chair, maybe it's a car, maybe it's a dog. But of course, we all have these concepts because we're adults. When children begin, the first things they experience, they're lying on their back inside their crib, and they look up and they have little things that dangle above them, and it's just colors and motion, and they have to put those things together. So they are able to put those things together and to make a little bit of sense. And those are the very, very elementary concepts. Then come things like a rattle that they hold in their hand. And a rattle is something that that is at the core of the concept of rattle. It's just the singular rattle, the one rattle that they have. But as time goes on, they generalize. The rattle becomes a general notion. Then it becomes more generalized to things I play with, that is, toys. At the same time, as Emmanuel said, there's the mommy who comes and is recognized by certain characteristic shapes. That mommy is eventually, when the child is one or two, becomes generalized to the mommies of other children. And then generalized to eventually to the more broad concept of a mother that includes the mother of animals, the mother of adults. At first, this seems mind-boggling to a child that an adult could have a mother, because the concept of mommy is limited to the mommies of children. But eventually that gets generalized. Then mommy becomes mother, and mother becomes an abstraction, becomes the abstraction of maternity. We could say that the American Revolution is the mother of the French Revolution. We're constantly generalizing, constantly seeing in new situations a deep essence that we are familiar with from previous experience.
So as we imagine that exponential growth of those, analogical connections over time, you eventually end up with what you call this sort of analogy machine in the human brain. So many connections between so many different observations that cumulatively you're saying this is our mind?
Yes, that's what we say.
That's the idea. Yeah.
At every moment of our lives, you write, our concepts are selectively triggered by analogies. I see something in my rearview mirror, and it's analogies that I'm using to make sense of it, Douglas?
Yeah, I think that's a good example, because when I drive, of course, I'm constantly looking in the rearview mirror. What am I trying to monitor? I'm trying to monitor things that are somewhat threatening. So if I see somebody weaving, I have a recognition of what that means from prior experiences driving. If I see somebody coming up very fast, I have a sense of fear of the person being very aggressive, possibly tailgating me, possibly doing things that are unpredictable. So I gauge what I see in the rearview mirror very, very rapidly, not by some kind of logic. It's not as if I reason it all out. It's because I have had experiences with those kinds of people before or those kinds of drivers before, and there are telltale signals I can take very, very – I can assess in a half second whether somebody is coming up fast, whether somebody is weaving, and so forth. So there's a very rapid perception of an essence.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about how our brains work, how we think, and the fundamental power, we're being told, of analogy in our minds. Everything like something, endlessly building, comparing. It's the thesis of Surfaces and Essences, Analogy as the Fuel and Fire of Thinking by my guests today, Douglas Hofstadter, who joins us from Bloomington, Indiana, and Emmanuel Sander joins us from just outside Paris, France. Big book, magnum opus, you could say. A lifetime of focus on this by Hofstadter and Emmanuel Sander chipping in big here. Here's a little bit from an episode of LearningGamesForKids.com. A teacher gives the basic lesson on what an analogy really is.
Analogies are statements that compare or contrast ideas that seem to have no relationship, but really do. Let's look at an example of an analogy. Hand is to glove as foot is to sock. Huh? Okay, let's look closer. Let's try saying it like this. A hand wears a glove the same way a foot wears a sock. See how that works?
Hand is to glove as foot is to sock. Multiply it by some very large number and off we go, they say, with the human mind. We've got lots of response, Douglas, Emmanuel. I want to put it to you. But first, let me just throw this one down for you. Maybe as an example. One form of analogy you talk about is using one's name as an analogy, a category marker for a set of similar things, the Chopin of springtime or the Einstein of ballet. Here's a scene from the NBC comedy Community. College student Jeff, played by Joel McHale, tells his psych major friend Britta, played by Gillian Ian, Gillian Jacobs, that she's messed up her test results, but he doesn't say messed up.
I think one member of our study group is an overzealous psych major. You probably just britted the test results somehow.
No, I double-checked them. Wait, are people using my name to mean make a small mistake?
Yes.
Yes, the answer is definitively yes. So her name is Britta. They say she's just britted the test results, and we've got, I don't know, is this an example, Douglas, of what you're talking about?
Yeah, it's a fine example. It's an abstraction, of course. It's simplifying the person down into one major trait. It's a cute example. I wanted to react a little bit to the teacher who said an analogy is the relationship where we take two things that seem to have no relationship but really do. I think that is a little bit misleading because it's
the
again
hand
it's
is to glove as foot is to sock. What about it?
Yeah, it suggests that analogies once again are sort of cognitive delicacies or rarities, and that we begin with something that seems very, very distant, and then we make some kind of deep connection. But I would like to give some examples that show that analogy is much, much more frequent than that. And so if we look at a little child of 2 years old who has just taken the peel off of a banana and is very proud of herself, and she says, "I undressed the banana." Now, what she's doing is she's reaching into her experience. She undresses a doll, or she herself is undressed by her mom when she's going to be put to bed. And it's a natural connection to her. It's not something she's not proud of, or she's not trying to make a piece of wordplay or to show off her knowledge of the language. She's simply reaching into her past experience and finding the closest counterpart to what she's just done to the banana. And she calls it undressing. And it's a natural thing for her, and it's not a rarity. It's just a choice of words. When children choose words, they are reaching into their experience and trying to find what have I seen before that is like what I'm just doing now or what I'm observing now. And it's by finding the central essence of the thing that's happening that they make their word choice. And that's analogy making.
Paul writes to us on Twitter, says, I believe it was Aldous Huxley who noted that genius was the ability to make metaphors, which are analogies at heart, Paul says, and it seems like you may be pointing in that direction too. But here's a skeptical listener, Douglas Emmanuel. Toy writes, the brain as analogy machine? I'm skeptical. This would mean that if there's a set of knowledge that has no analogy, it will never be discovered. Ask yourself if this is true. You'll need to prove it. So you see, and counterexamples here given at our website. It says, complex numbers were not born out of analogies, but necessity to solve polynomial equations. The analogous geometric interpretation came later, or the invention of non-Euclidean geometry, our listener asserts, did not come by the analogy of space bending. It came by looking at the logical consequence of modifying Euclidean parallel postulate. What do you say, Douglas?
Well, let's take imaginary numbers. The birth of imaginary numbers, if you really look into the history, came in Italy in about the 1500s, and it was because people were trying to solve the cubic equation, trying to use machinery that was similar to the machinery they had solved the quadratic with. Everybody learns in high school that to solve a quadratic equation, it involves a formula minus b plus or minus the square root of b squared minus 4ac over 2a. That's something you learn in eighth or ninth grade. That's the formula for solving a quadratic, and it involves a square root. Well, people in mathematics naturally assumed that they made an analogy for the cubic. They thought, well, there must be some similar formula for a cubic equation. And so this was the idea was starting out by an analogy, trying to find a similar formula. There's something called completing the square, which is done for quadratics, and they did the analogous thing, which was completing the cube. And eventually, these Italian mathematicians did solve the cubic equation, and they found that there was a cube root in it. And that led them to algebraic expressions that they had never seen before, because they involved not only a cube root but also a square root, and sometimes the square root was of a negative number. And they didn't know what to do with this expression that was a square root of a negative number. But eventually Bombelli, who was the person who really first found how to manipulate imaginary and complex numbers, he started manipulating these things by analogy with the numbers that he was familiar with. He allowed them to – he used the commutative law that A plus B equals B plus A for addition and multiplication. He used the distributive law for multiplication. And he found that he could play around with these mysterious quantities as if they were familiar objects. And so he found himself in the world of complex numbers thanks to a whole bunch of analogies, a long succession of analogies. And that's the actual history of how imaginary numbers, or the square root of minus one, or whatever you want to call them, were invented.
Toy, there's plenty to chew on there. Douglas Hofstadter and Emmanuel Sander with us from Bloomington, Indiana, and just outside Paris. Callers here, David in Franklin, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling, David. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that this seems to me like a regurgitation of Locke's tabula rasa, so that we come to life with minds that are blank slates, and we build our minds as we grow up by making analogies. I agree that we have the capability to make analogies. It's a strong capability in our minds. But I think that this theory disallows for the possibility of creativity and inspiration in creating anything new. And I believe that we are capable of creating new things. If we look at science, Einstein, the story has it, came up with the general theory of relativity by after a dream he had where he was riding on a beam of light. You know, many people, many artists create new things. And I think that, yes, we use analogy to negotiate our worlds, but I think that we are also very creative and capable of coming up with new things.
The creation of the new, the brand spanking new. Emmanuel Sander, in France, you yes. and Douglas write about Einstein in particular. What about that example?
Yeah, it's. I think the idea is that something is never 100% new, and newness is there's a kind of relativity in this idea. So the example that we take for instance the one of Einstein is that it's some very abstract analogies that were not done before that makes the thing to be creative, and it's not there is no contradiction between being creative and making analogies, because some people make analogies, they're the first to make, and they see some generalizations that were not seen before them. So there is no reason to make opposition between both of them. Maybe Douglas, you want to...
Yeah, I think it would be good to point out that the caller spoke of the invention of general relativity. Mm-hmm. Once again, if you look at the history, and we discuss this very in great detail in Chapter 8 of our book, the history of many analogies by Einstein. In the case of general relativity, it all came out of an analogy that he made between acceleration and gravitation. And he noticed that... acceleration and gravitation had very deep properties in common. He made a very powerful and novel analogy, and that was the breakthrough moment that allowed him to go ahead and create general relativity. There are lots of analogies in the creation of general relativity. It's not just one analogy. It's many. There was another analogy with fictitious forces. Analogies just pile on top of each other in Einstein's thinking, and the last chapter is actually largely devoted to how Einstein came up with many of his most profound ideas, and they're all analogies. Every single one is an analogy, and of course Einstein, we've chose him deliberately because he is certainly among the most creative individuals who ever lived, and the truth of the matter is that everything he did was by analogy.
So what about our caller's example, dreaming of riding on a beam of light? Does that, to you, qualify as then the dream?
Well, that was a
dream
that Einstein had, that he was intrigued by that idea. It made him think, but that's not where special relativity, that's not exactly where special relativity came from. It was a spark. Just to correct the caller, I don't want to nitpick, but that was for special relativity, not general relativity. But the idea was that Einstein was trying to understand the idea that light could travel in a vacuum, and that if he could catch up with light, it would not be moving. But it's a long story, and I don't want to get into the story of the ether and all the complexities of special relativity, but Einstein was beginning at about age 16 to think about the deep mystery of a wave propagating in a vacuum. And that was the central mystery that was so confusing, and again, it was a question of trying to make analogies. How can a wave propagate in a vacuum? In other words, when there's no medium, waves need a medium, and so Einstein was very puzzled by this, and he made a deep analogy, which gave rise to special relativity. I don't want to go into it in detail, but the analogy was a generalization of Galileo's principle of relativity. It became a more general principle of relativity that gave rise to special relativity. And it was another analogy.
And off we go. If you buy the basic premise, you see sort of this endless fractal array of analogy. Jackie's calling from Los Angeles, California. Hi, Jackie. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I completely buy into the analogous brain, and I have a question. For instance, in somebody with autism where it's hard to make analogies, is there a way to teach someone to understand and make analogies?
Wow. Douglas, how about it?
Actually, I think people who are autistic may not be terribly good at understanding human relations, but many autistic people are very good at making connections between things. And the question of teaching, though, is an interesting one. We deal with it in one of the chapters on naive analogies, and maybe Emmanuel could take that up a little bit.
Naive analogy, Emmanuel?
Yeah, sure. So first thing I would like to say is that since we always make analogies, in unconscious analogies, it means that it's not something that need to be learned, because it's the way human mind works. But sometimes it's useful to help people to discover the more relevant, the more efficient analogies, and especially in education in school. And so the naive analogies are the analogies that we make spontaneously before we receive the school education. For instance, the naive analogy for subtraction is to take away, to take something out from something else. So naive analogy to division is sharing. And these naive analogies, they have to be overcome if we want the pupils to understand better the mathematics, because they are very helpful at the beginning, because it's a way to discover a mathematical concept. But in another way, they are limiting, because sometimes it doesn't allow to understand properly some mathematical situations. Then it becomes very important to help the pupils to discover the more efficient analogies. And one possibility is to lead them to make comparison between two situations. So this kind of comparison will help to discover more abstract analogies, which will be more relevant.
Emmanuel Sander, stand by if you'd be good enough there in Saint-Denis, France, and Douglas Hofstetter in Bloomington, Indiana. The big new book is Surfaces and Essences. Analogy is the fuel and fire of thinking. There's a little song by Leo Ferré. Tells the story of an accordion player described as the Chopin of springtime. Analogy. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Le piano du pauvre, c'est le Chopin du printemps. Sous le soleil mauve, des lilas de novembre. Il roucoule un brin à ceux qui se plaisent bien et fait des avances. Ce Ravel ou machin, c'est déjà la fin, mais v'là qui recommence. Le piano du pauvre se noue autour des reins. Sa chanson guimauve, ça va toujours très loin. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about how our brains work, how we think, and the fundamental power of analogy in our minds, everything like something, endlessly building, comparing. Douglas Hofstetter and Emmanuel Sander are with us, co-authors of the big new book, Surfaces and Essences, Analogy as the Fuel and Fire of Thinking. Steven Pinker at Harvard calls it a milestone in our understanding of human thought. Hey, if you look around, you can see it almost everywhere. January, President Obama pushed Congress to raise the debt ceiling. He used an analogy to explain why the U.S. needs to pay its bills.
This is not a complicated concept. You don't go out to dinner and then, you know, eat all you want and then leave without paying the check. And if you do, you're breaking the law.
The president laying down the law with analogy there. We begin to think about just how far this goes. Our listeners are certainly thinking, Douglas, Emmanuel, Justin writes, he says, music sociologists believe that when we hear new music, we weigh it against all the music we have ever heard thus far, and we judge it based on that. Is that an example of analogic thinking, Douglas, or just, I don't know, comparing to what we've heard?
Yeah, it's a bit extreme, I think, to say that when we hear a new piece of music that we're bringing to bear every single thing that we've ever heard in music. I think it makes more sense to say that what it does is that the piece of music that we're hearing immediately suggests a flavor. That is, it might suggest to me, since I'm I have certain musical tastes, it might suggest to me that it's romantic. It might suggest that it's Slavic. I would say, oh, this is a piano piece. It might say, oh, this sounds like Chopin, but it's maybe a little bit different. So perhaps it's by somebody, maybe it's by somebody who lived at about the period of Chopin in a Slavic country, and so forth. So I make analogies to prior music that I knew, but I don't. I'm not relying on every single thing I've ever heard in music. Not all the salsa music that I've ever heard, or all of the rock and roll, et cetera, et cetera. I immediately zoom in, I sort of focus in quickly. The thinking involves the art of elimination. We focus in on what something most centrally is, and pay attention to the crux of it rather than to evoking everything that we know. That would be it would create a fantastic jumble in our mind, and we have to do precisely the opposite. We have to zero in on what is most relevant in any given situation. So when you referred to a debt ceiling, the word ceiling gives you the sense immediately of something that you can't go above.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives you a very clear impression of an upper threshold. You can't go beyond a certain limit. That's a very nice usage of words that is clearly using an analogy to a very familiar concept and extending the concept of ceiling in a slightly abstract way. You also referred to a fractal array of analogy, again, making an analogy to fractals, which we're now all familiar with.
Pull back the curtain a little bit for us. For those of us who aren't cognitive scientists, here's Pinker saying this is a milestone in our understanding of human thought. Is it controversial? Are there streams of thought in opposition to this that you're running up against? Is this at one level, when you describe it, then it starts to sound obvious. But in the world of cognitive science, is this a controversial assertion?
I would say it's a controversial assertion because analogy has still a tendency to be seen as a specific psychological mechanism devoted to problem solving or to special kinds of reasoning. And even if the researchers involved in the field really say that it's very important mechanism, it's not yet clear what is the connection between analogy making and concept development. And what we really say in our book is that building a concept and making analogies are absolutely inseparable. And this is something quite new, and also the unification from the very simpler perception mechanism or everyday speech conversation up to the creative scientific discoveries and creative acts. This is also something which was not said before. So there is a controversial part, yes.
David, we've got a listener here, Douglas. David is asking, and this takes us into the philosophical realm a little bit, but I'm interested how this might squeeze through that keyhole. David just writes simply, do we create our reality with our thoughts. Douglas?
The word "our" in that sentence suggests that reality is a subjective perception. If we say our reality, it suggests that my reality is not the same as yours and so forth. Well, of course, to some degree that makes sense. Each of us lives our own life and we have our own tastes and our own abilities. And in that sense, yes, of course, we all create our own realities. But at the same time, we live in a world that is shared, and it's because we are all able to share things that we perceive some of the same things. That is why words are universal. We all understand that there are concepts like mother and rattle and road and tailgating and slippery slope and so forth. And these are things that we all share and that we all belong to the common reality that we all share. And so there is a mixture of subjective and objective in the creation of everybody's own personal world.
You know, as I read this, for some reason I found myself thinking about, I mean, we're drawing here on pools of experience by analogy and building up our mind, our understanding of the world through those, as you suggest here. Of course, there are subtle differences between pools of experience. And we've seen human efforts in history, some quite terrible, but look back at Pol Pot, you know, who wanted the year zero, wanted to wipe the slate clean because that pool of experience or that stream of experience seemed like a bad one. They wanted to break with it. What about the idea that we could be in good or bad streams of experience that we're drawing our analogies from, and the effort to try and, you know, these are chains that could empower us, but people have also felt imprisoned sometimes by this sense of we can work with nothing but what we've got around us and we don't like what we've got around us.
Well, yes. I mean, when we're in a situation, there are all sorts of analogs that we can find to a situation. And so it's true that in certain situations, one can make what you might call bad analogies. And those bad analogies can infect an entire population. Perhaps we're seeing that in today's America, where the analogy is being made between Muslims and violence. And so it's as if one example of a violent person allows us to make a huge leap and come to a crazy conclusion. That's a bad analogy. It takes a little more work for the average American who perhaps doesn't have a lot of experience with the Muslim world to go out and learn something about it, to find exposure, to watch movies that take place in countries like Iran, and to learn that the people there are much more like ourselves than one might think from just the simplistic analogy that all Muslims are violent. I mean, so we have to learn how to pick and choose among our perceptions of the world, and it's very easy to fall for stereotypes. Stereotypes are rampant, and it's also necessary for us to have stereotypes. I mean, we can't know everything in infinite detail. We have to make snap judgments, as you've said several times. We're in a subtle bind. That is, we have to make decisions very quickly. We have to make snap judgments. We have to depend on stereotypes. And at the same time, stereotypes may be extremely misleading. And we have to learn, we have to be very careful about not going into a world of, as you say, bad analogies and getting pulled down very bad tracks.
Richard in Needham, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling, Richard. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. My question has to do with what you touched on a moment ago about whether the analogy approach is controversial with respect to other theories, specifically Noam Chomsky's theory of language acquisition, which, as I understand, is based on the idea that humans are born with an inherent pre-wired genetic ability as to language acquisition. And one of his main arguments is that first language acquisition occurs was such, as he puts it, a poverty of stimulus, a poverty of experiences. that it can't be explained other than by looking at an inherited language acquisition device.
Is that in opposition to your theory, Emmanuel?
I don't say it would be really an opposition to our theory. We don't take position about the question of innate mechanisms, but what we say is that, in fact, there are more degree of freedom than what Chomsky was thinking, because, in fact, what we say is that it is really the kind of situation that we experiment in our lives that constrains the development of our concepts and the kind of analogies that we will make, which means that we put more the emphasis on the constraints which are coming from the environment than from the innate constraints. And when doing this, many researchers now take such a position. The idea of that all our language would be so strictly constrained by innate structures is now very controversial.
Douglas Hofstadter, but to our callers' question, if Chomsky is saying that, you know, we're sort of pre-wired, that we go to language even with a poverty of experience, doesn't that suggest something bigger or deeper than analogy as the fire of thought?
Well, what Chomsky was talking about is grammar. That's what Chomsky's theories are about. They're not about all of language. I mean, there's a tendency among linguists to equate language with grammar. But the truth of the matter is that language, the difficulty of language is not the rules of grammar. But although they are certainly difficult, but the acquisition of concepts, that is, concepts that are labeled, what we do when dogs don't have language and they have very few concepts. The difference between dogs and people is that people are able to make an ever-extending repertoire of concepts. They can put concepts together, build larger and larger concepts. I like to take the concept of a hub airport because it's just three letters hub. You say Denver is a hub for frontier. And it's an amazingly rich concept. This has nothing to do with grammar. This has to do with the complexity buried in the word hub.
It has
to do in order
to understand. I see immediately all these planes coming in from all directions.
Not only do you have to understand the concept of hub of a wheel, but you have to understand what airports are. You have to know what airplanes are. You have to know what airlines are. You have to know what a trip can be decomposed into legs of a trip. You have to understand the idea of downsizing because hubs were created in order to downsize the airlines, make them have fewer flights instead of connecting cities all around. You have to understand economics, economic pressures, on and on. All of that in a simple three-word, one-syllable word, hub. No dog is going to understand that. And this has nothing to do with Chomsky and grammar.
What about computers? You know, never mind dogs. What about computers? they keep rising in their capacity. Can they jump on the same bandwagon? Are they on the same bandwagon? Can they, the singularity, will they surpass us even in analogy recognition, manipulation?
Well, there's nothing to prevent computers from being able to do analogies, except that analogies are very subtle, because to make a good analogy, you have to be able to pinpoint the crux of a situation, and you have to have a deep way of, as I said, the art of elimination. You have to have a deep way of looking at a situation and knowing what counts and what doesn't count. And the crux of situations is not something that computers today are good at isolating. My research for the past 30 years in my little research group has been to try to make computer models of analogy making, and we've gotten somewhere, but it's proven to be fantastically hard, even in micro domains, let alone the domain of the entire world, even in little teeny weeny micro domains. So analogy making is a very, very deep art. So there's nothing to prevent computers in the end from becoming good at analogy making, but we're very, very far from that at this point in time.
The human strength, maybe the human way, the mind as analogy machine, explored in great depth and detail in the big new book by Douglas Hofstadter and Emmanuel Sander, Surfaces and Essences, Analogy as the Fuel and Fire of Thinking. Grateful to both of you for being with us this hour. Douglas Hofstadter, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Emmanuel Sander in Saint-Denis, France. Thank you so much, Professor Sander.
Thank you. Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.